Welcome one, welcome all to WOB Radio. This is fellow worker Noah kicking off with our song today. Today we're going to be singing Hallelujah, I'm a Bum from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW. It was written by Harry Haywire Mac McClintock, who's one of our famous singers here in the union. Why don't you work like other folks do? How the hell can I work when there's no work to do? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Oh, why don't you save all the money you earn? If I didn't eat, I'd have money to burn.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Oh, I like my boss. He's a good friend of mine. That's why I'm starving out on the bread line.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Oh, why speed up work till you're ready to fall? If you'd only slow down, there'd be work for us all.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
But don't you complain, don't open your eyes, don't talk revolution and don't organize.
Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Good afternoon, evening, morning, folks. I'm fellow worker Lynn, and I've been part of WOBS, the Wobblies, or the Industrial Workers of the World, for several years now. I'm very proud of that. I'm a union working woman. I'm retired, but I was a union working woman from a union family. Three members of my family were union, at least. Some of them I don't know. Anyway, this show is to entertain and educate you, hopefully, and we'd like to hear from you on Facebook or other means. Other people will explain. So please keep in contact with us. Let us know you're listening.
I'm fellow worker Marilyn, retired mental health worker in the community mental health field. I've been a member since about 2008, and if you're listening and you would like to join the Wobblies, the IWW, I'm a delegate, and I can give you an introduction and sign you up. If you are interested, the IWW considers all workers, whether they're paid or not, to be fellow workers. If you're stuck at home caring for your family or caring for an aged parent or relative, you're still a worker. We can sign you up, and we have a sliding scale for dues.
Hi, listeners. I'm fellow worker Gordon. He, him pronouns. I've been... I live in Bremerton because I'm retired out of the Naval Shipyard out there. I'm a member of the Tacoma branch, the Tacoma General Membership branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, and I've been a member since around 2008. So I'm a retiree also, but still involved with union activity because of our pretty broad definition of who a worker is and who can contribute to the cause.
Hey guys, hello gals, and howdy to all my non-binary friends and pals. I'm a retired nurse, 18 years as a psychiatric meds nurse, and before that I worked in the timber biz. I joined the IWW in the 70s. I've been in and out over the years. I think it's a really good idea. It's an alternative to what we have now, and what we got now ain't good. So let's work and organize to make this place a good place to live.
My name is fellow worker Noah. I'm the Tacoma branch's branch secretary. I'm also kind of our local in-house producer for WOB Radio. I've been in the IWW since March of 2021, and ever since then, I've been a delegate, I've helped out on a bunch of different committees, assisted others with their organizing campaigns, and back in March, I got elected branch secretary. So I'm also a delegate, like fellow worker Marilyn, so if you are interested in joining the IWW or learning more, you can always reach out to our Facebook or Instagram pages and get connected with a local organizer and delegate. So it's a pleasure for everybody to be tuning in today, and I hope that what we provide you is informative as well as entertaining.
Greetings, fellow workers and listeners. I'm going to read the preamble to the Constitution of the Industrial Workers of the World. This was written back in 1905 when we founded the union in Chicago. And it's pretty much our mission statement. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Moving on into our labor news section of our radio show, we have a few articles that we'd like to present about local and national organizing campaigns that are going on in a variety of different unions, including ours. So I have a pretty interesting article today, and this is a sector of work that has been getting more and more of an organizing kick over the past couple of years. So there's a game studio called Bethesda. They've made a bunch of number one video games over the past several years. If any of our fellow listeners are familiar with the Fallout series, they helped develop and produce that. But the Bethesda video game workers recently organized a wall-to-wall union of artists, programmers, production staff, and other people that are working within that industry. But the reason why this is really cool organizing campaign that recently got accomplished is because I don't think a whole lot of people are aware of the working conditions for people who work not just in television and film, but also video games as well. They often suffer a lot of the same crappy working conditions, whether that's, you know, management pushing workers to crunch or essentially go into overtime to put in more labor during the amount of hours that they're scheduled to work in order to get a product on the shelves sooner. There's also been complaints about poor wages, and also the inability to organize in some of these video game industries because some of them are treated as contract workers. And contract workers in many places, either due to state or even sometimes federal laws, are prohibited from organizing. So this is from Kotaku.com. They're a very popular video games and other related media site. Basically, Bethesda Game Studios unionized, and this was an article published by Ethan Gatch on July 22nd, 2024. On July 19th, owner Microsoft recognized a union representing 241 staff at Bethesda, which is behind the Elder Scrolls and Fallout franchises, and released last year's sprawling sci-fi adventure Starfield. The group, which will be represented by the Communications Workers of America, the CWA, includes artists, designers, programmers, and engineers from the roughly 450-person studio. Unlike recent unionization efforts at Activision, Blizzard, ZeniMax, and beyond, which focus primarily on quality assurance testers, this wall-to-wall union represents workers from all across the different disciplines and departments needed to make the blockbuster hits Bethesda is famous for. It's similar to the union at Sega of America, which represents staff from across the organization's marketing, localization, and community management teams. So that's kind of interesting because, you know, we talk a lot in the IWW about having wall-to-wall unions within an industry, all the departments organized into a similar job branch so they can all look out for each other. And this is kind of a similar campaign in a very big, very famous video game studio. So I think it's pretty interesting. And congratulations to the workers with the CWA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you say that these folks work for Microsoft?
So Bethesda is a video game studio that's owned by Microsoft, and Microsoft recognized the union at Bethesda. Mm-hmm. So from what I also read, they had a pretty high turnout for it as well. It was like an overwhelming majority of people wanted to join the union. And like I said, in a lot of video game studios, it tends to be a very intense timeline of work because from the time that a project is announced to the time that it's released, they have to do an incredible amount of work in production, programming, the artwork for a video game, things like that.
It's intense.
It's intense. And in a lot of video game studios, I mentioned earlier, there is often a crunch culture of essentially you are often not told to overwork, but you are heavily encouraged to overwork.
There's also a lot of ageism in that profession. So I've seen workers that are a little bit older get harassed and squeezed out.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of ageism, there's also been a lot of organizing around gender equity in those workplaces as well. A lot of the women who worked on some of the early video games, especially ones that were produced out of Japan, weren't allowed to credit themselves by name. They had to come up with a pseudonym. There's actually, I'll send you this article, fellow worker Marilyn. It's about the Nintendo women for the early editions of video games back in like the 80s and 90s, and how they fought for recognition in order to be recognized for the massive amount of work that they did on really, really popular video game series. Fellow worker Gordon?
Was this in Japan or is this in the United States?
Specifically, the Nintendo women were from Japan. Yeah. So a lot of them were encouraged or were forced to use pseudonyms so that they wouldn't get direct credit. And these are women who have worked on like literally hundreds of video games and did not receive proper credit, let alone proper pay for it.
Well, you know, this is a little bit of a lateral move, but the U.S., when it was in the middle of the space race, a lot of brilliant women worked for them and were never, ever, ever given credit.
Right.
Now
the computers.
Yeah.
They called them computers before they were electronic. Those were the women who did the calculations and the, you know, the grunt work mathematics.
But you see, it's supposed to be a good old boys' game.
Right.
Right.
Well, it was back in the 60s. Yeah. They were all test pilots and macho military types back then.
So our next article that we have lined up in our outline here is, this is about the Teamsters again. The Teamsters are trying to do this multipolar elections program within their union. I actually just recently received mail for this from the Teamsters local that I'm a part of through my work. And there's been a lot of discussion and controversy as to why the Teamsters president has been really schmoozing up to Donald Trump, other conservative figures.
Right. Inquiring minds want to know.
Right. In the election pamphlet that they sent me, they did do a good job in trying to give every candidate that's currently running an equal amount of page space to talk about, like, this is their person's labor record and so on and so forth. And they seem to kind of do a bit of a spit shine when it came to Donald Trump's section of the voters pamphlet that they sent out.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that they tried to play up the way that Donald Trump, quote unquote, tried to improve conditions for workers and economic recovery and stuff like that. The Teamsters essentially have a very centrist approach to how they're looking forward to the election season coming up in the next actively going on right now. They're trying to give each candidate an equal amount of consideration by the union. And their internal union program for this is called Drive. It's trying to get people to go vote regardless of who they're voting for, which is very different from a lot of other major unions who have spoken.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because a lot of the other major unions are like, hey, we want to support this Democratic candidate because they are part of a party that allegedly has a
pro-capitalist party.
Yes, a pro-capitalist party that allegedly has a better labor record when it comes to protecting workers' rights and stuff. Whereas the Teamsters is kind of like, here's all these candidates, I guess we'll give them an equal amount of time and let our fellow workers kind of figure it out, like what candidate they want to support.
Well,
it's this very mealy-mouthed approach.
But it's not that different in a way than the IWW approach, which is, we are a labor union, we are not a political party, and we don't tell people how to vote. We educate people about where their interests lie, and that's it.
And I think that that is a very interesting comparison there, because you're right. The IWW does not endorse specific...
But we're not going and having lunch with Trump either.
No, we're not. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
Just to make note of the fact that, and we'll be discussing this later on in the program, but there are a lot of mainstream union members, I mean, AFL-CIO affiliates, who are politically very conservative. And perhaps Teamsters leadership, recognizing this, are trying to sort of appeal to that part of their rank and file. So I can understand it as a tactical move, but I watched the entire address, and I was pretty shocked. I mean, if you would have closed your eyes and didn't see all the bunting and the Trump signs, you would have thought that Sean was delivering a lecture at the Democratic convention. The language was very kind of old-fashioned labor, and I was surprised at the content. You could hear the audience was not exactly enthused about it, but all that being said, I mean, the written message was pretty right on. But that aside, I think he played into the hands of the Trump campaign, because that lent a certain amount of legitimacy to Trump's claims of being for the working man, which are obviously untrue, like most of the stuff he says. But what I'm getting at is that maybe I could see the reasoning of Teamster leadership to be even-handed and, you know, bipartisan and all that kind of stuff. But in the final result, I think he just played into their hands.
Yeah, and some of the conservative dog whistles he was giving in that speech were also particularly eye-questioning. He kind of went on a little miniature rant about trans people there for a minute.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was like...
That was cringy.
Cringy doesn't come pass. But, no, the funny thing is that he's also requested to speak at the upcoming 2024 Democratic National Convention, right, although his request has not been granted by July 15th. That's from Wikipedia, so you can take that with however many grains of salt that you want. But I want to go back to what fellow worker Marilyn said, because there is kind of a slight comparison to the Teamsters and the IWW in that. The Teamsters have this very, any political candidate will do, here's kind of this very even field assessment of every political candidate, and we'll leave it up to our membership to endorse one, versus the IWW, which specifically does not endorse political candidates or parties. We kind of leave it up to fellow workers to make that decision on their own, although... Personally, knowing the membership of the IWW, I would assume that a lot of people would vote for predominantly left-wing candidates.
And the other difference is that the other union, the one that we were talking about, Teamsters, they didn't stay neutral. They spent time in Mar-a-Lago.
Mm-hmm.
And people see that, and they make assumptions. And they know that members are making assumptions.
Right.
So it's not actually even-handed. It's a show of looking even-handed, which is just... not true.
Well, just to elaborate on that just a little bit, is that I personally had great hopes for the Teamsters because, you know, I grew up during the era where the Teamsters were almost synonymous with being mobbed up, and they were a corrupt union, and they, you know, very undemocratic. But then the leadership got changed a few years ago with Teamsters for a Democratic Union. So I kind of bought into that story. I had high hopes that that was actually happening, that they were going to become a more democratic union and a more, you know, diverse union. This message, once again, it just sent all the wrong vibes to me. And if I'm affected and I'm not a Teamster, imagine the rank and file in the union itself.
I can speak internally from what I've heard from other Teamsters at my work, as well as from what I've heard from the union at large through their internal communications, that a lot of people in the union are not happy about this trying to cuddle up to the Republicans, because yes, like you said, there is definitely a conservative element in the Teamsters, but I would argue that there's a much larger faction of the Teamsters that are more pro-labor in general, and probably recognize that the Democratic candidate, regardless of whether or not they're actually going to follow through on it, is at the very least more vocally pro-labor. And internally, there's also somebody announced a run for presidency within the Teamsters, not for the country, but for the union, and specifically called out the president, Sean O'Brien, and said, this person is trying to cuddle up to anti-union elements in the political sphere. They're endorsing a candidate who is very racist and xenophobic and does not represent the better interests of unions in general. And I'm going to be running internally for president in order to beat this person.
Good.
Because this approach to politics, at least within that union, is going to come around to bite us in the butt. It was very strongly worded. I'm surprised that he didn't curse. So, yeah, hopefully things internally for the Teamsters will improve, maybe after the election cycle. But, yeah, and this is going to, of course, lead into a roundtable discussion that we have planned later in the show, talking about how there are reactionary elements within unions and how we do need to actually take them seriously and figure out how to address them. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
To me, it would have been better... justice-wise, in my opinion, if they had met maybe with Trump in some neutral place, you know, but to go down to his place, his headquarters,
his home, yeah,
that was just too cozy, just too ugly of a message.
Yeah. So the last news article that we have lined up, Starbucks workers are kind of split on no-strike clauses?
SEIU, the organizers of Starbucks, are split. Some of them want to sign a contract with a no-strike clause, which means you give up your power at the job. Until the contract expires, and then you haggle about it, as opposed to workers who do not have a strike clause in their contract, which means when things are intolerable, you put down your cup, and you go out the door and let the bus make coffee for you because nobody else will. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. It's been pointed out before within our group that the right to cease labor, to stop making a profit for the boss, is a very efficient tool.
Yes.
To get what you want. In fact, there may be no other way to do it. Mm-hmm. That is as successful. So I think that this issue has not been resolved, and I wait to hear more. But I think a no-strike clause is a losing strategy.
Do you know where you first heard about that from the SEIU organizers?
A telephone. I don't know where.
Okay. Yeah, it would be interesting if we could talk about that again at the next episode, because I think that that is... I know that we've had the conversation, but it would be interesting to bring it up again, because we're talking about a major trade union in this country having an internal discussion about no-strike clauses, which I feel like is kind of rare, honestly. A lot of major unions like to say, look, if you just turn over the right to strike for this period of 2 to 3 to 5 years, you'll get this nice contract, the employer will be beholden to it just as we are, and you'll get what you want. But that kind of shoots yourself in the foot by, like you said, taking away the one thing that workers can do effectively, which is stop working if they have grievances. So I think that that's pretty interesting to be happening within the SEIU. So the SEIU has 1.9 million members to date. So that's a pretty big trade union asking that question.
And they were a bit more radical, I think, about a year ago. They did some... I'm not remembering the specifics, but some things that sounded really good.
Mm-hmm. Once again, it varies from local to local and region to region. So,
and I think I know what you're talking about, Marilyn, in the sense that the Starbucks Workers Union, that's really been driving a hard bargain, to say the least, for the past 2 or 3 years and getting a lot of these workplaces organized. I know that within the past couple of months, they've recently put it out to the public that, like, hey, Starbucks seems like they're willing to sit down with us. They've kind of given us some key indicators that they might want to start finally sitting down and drawing up contracts, but there hasn't really been much news outside of that. So from what I've been able to see, the unionization campaign at Starbucks, at their local shops, has kind of been slowing down a bit as the union on a national level is kind of waiting for the corporate people to sit down with them. Did you have one more news article you'd like to report on, Philip?
Yeah, just briefly. I picked this article up. I get a newsletter from an outfit called Portside, which is an aggregating site for news that is of interest to labor. So once again, it's from the Portside website. And the article was written by a worker named Ben Carroll on the Labor Notes website, which is also a pretty good one for getting alternative news about the labor movement. Anyway, the title of the article is New Battery Belt Opens Organizing Front in the South. And what he means by a battery belt is just a swath of factories that are being built now, and some of them have already been built, that are laying the infrastructure for electric vehicles. And of course, that, you know, one of them's vertical, meaning that they start with the battery and they build the car and they fit the battery in the car. And so it's a sort of a, you know, start to finish type factory, reminiscent of the River Rouge plant in Dearborn, I believe. No, it was in Flint. And back in the 1930s, it sounds like the same organizational structure. So what's happening is that a lot of the foreign automobile makers have decided that they're going to build batteries and cars in the United States because, and especially in the South, which are mostly right-to-work states, they can get cheap labor. That's all there is to that. And, of course, the hostile governments down in the South of our country are hostile to labor. So we're talking right-to-work states like North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky,
Arizona.
Places like that, yeah, and Alabama. So anyway, what I'm getting at is that on the one hand, when you read the article, you say, oh boy, you know, 5,100 workers are going to get hired, you know, and that sounds pretty good, you know, on the outside of it. It sounds like, okay, they're bringing jobs to the South. But the reality of it, and the UAW, the United Auto Workers, can tell you that the workers are treated like crap and they're paid below, you know, running wages for the exact same jobs in other parts of the country like Michigan and Illinois. So, and there are other things to consider. It would be easy to get charged with being an anti-ecology person because you don't want to see it easier to make electric vehicles. That article, that belief can be spun. You know, like, oh, so you don't want to see, you want to see pollution from traditional cars. No, I don't. I just want to see equitable treatment of the workers who are building these cars, whether they're electric or they run on cosmic rays, it doesn't really matter. They are not going to get treated to decent contracts or decent working conditions in where they're building these factories, like Kings Mountain, North Carolina, and other places in Tennessee and Georgia even. Hyundai is going to get up to $2.1 billion, with a B, dollars in tax breaks from the state of Georgia for building this big electric vehicle plant outside of Savannah. So this is a real touchy subject, because I don't want to deny anybody the possibility of getting a union job. You know, that is a blessing for all families, really, because you have some measure of security, some measure of wage growth as you go along in years with the company. But it's very big, you know. They're in an industry that is leaving a very bad carbon footprint, making these batteries so that, let's face it, middle-class white people can feel less guilt about polluting the air, right? The building of these batteries in and of itself is a highly toxic and dangerous industry. And so I worry, especially if we have a certain candidate win the presidency, that worker safety things are just going to go right out the window. And we'll see an increased level of injury and death from handling toxic materials, working in heat. These are the same, you know, usual suspects that have denied agricultural workers water breaks down there in Texas and down there in the South, right? So the best interests of the workers are, you know, not their highest priority. So my whole point about the article is that you got to look at, you got to read, you got to research, got to educate yourself to see who's going to benefit and who's not going to benefit or actually fall behind. So I would have to do a lot more research than just one article to condemn it. But I know the usual modus operandi of capitalism, which is to cut costs to the bone, which includes labor costs, environmental costs, inspections, regulations. They don't want any of that stuff, so they can make the most money they can. And once again, it's not your usual big three evil, you know, Ford, General Motors, and whatever the new name, Stellantis or whatever it was. It used to be Chrysler. Now it's Toyota and Mercedes-Benz and Volvo and these companies that kind of traditionally we looked at as, oh, perhaps they're more progressive. I mean, all the cool people I know used to drive Volkswagens, you know, but what I'm getting at is that, like certain nonprofits that have a really high-minded and high-sounding name, they don't treat their workers right either. So do a little research. You can find any of these articles on the Portside site or on Labor Notes or any of those websites that deal with labor news. So just do a little bit more research before you declare it a victory for the working class.
All right, fellow workers, and now we're going to be moving on to our roundtable discussion of the episode. Every episode of WOB Radio, we have a roundtable discussion with all of our fellow workers assembled about a timely topic in regards to labor organizing or social justice or the environment. And this is a pretty interesting one because we did talk about this a little bit in the labor news section. Politically reactionary elements within a lot of the trade unions, such as the Teamsters president cozying up to Donald Trump, or the fact that a lot of trade union workers are still very much conservative themselves, even though they benefit off of the labor union or a labor movement that has been notably progressive over history.
Well, you know what? Unions are made up of individuals.
That's fair. Yeah. But I think that there is an overall conservative tone within a lot of the trade unions, and not necessarily conservative in the term, in the sense of conservative as political, but also conservative in the sense of they don't really have that much of a vision for what the future of labor is going to look like, the way that the IWW does. They might also be conservative in terms of their methods.
Can I call you on something?
Go ahead.
Historically, the word conservative means to conserve.
Right.
And that has changed now. And I would not use the word conservative in describing what's happening politically in our country. It's not conservative. It is reactionary. Mm-hmm. It is Neolithic.
I would also be open to using the term regressive.
Yes.
It's going backwards instead of going forwards.
I'm conservative about resources.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's a different kind of conservative, yeah.
Yeah, I'm conservative about protecting the environment. Mm-hmm. But that word conservative no longer, I think, is specifically accurate in describing people who are backward-leaning.
Right. No, yeah, that's actually a really good point.
Yeah, it ain't your grandpa's William F. Buckley anymore.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Another fellow worker, when we were coming up with this roundtable idea, they made an allegory between the LIUNA Union and United Mine Workers of America in terms of, like, labor solidarity and environmentalism. Which fellow worker was that again?
Could have been me.
I believe we were talking about Judy Berry.
Yes, we also talked about Judy Berry and the collaboration between unionism and environmentalism and how those two things, even though unionism nowadays tends to be, what was the term that you used? Reactionary and regressive in certain ways, in terms of how they organize. Mm-hmm. There have been great moments of collaboration with unionists and, say, environmentalists, or people who campaign on other social justice-related issues as well. Mm-hmm. Fellow Worker Gordon?
Yeah, as I think I thought I was bringing up, we were talking about LIUNA the last broadcast meeting because of the labor that they volunteered to the IWW down there in Centralia. Mm-hmm. And I brought up the point that, however, LIUNA is very much in favor of building pipelines, all kinds of pipelines, oil pipelines, everything else, because it gives work to their members. So on a strictly self-interest angle, LIUNA could be really backwards and can, while looking out for their workers, you know, they're contributing to environmental disaster. And instead of, you know, hating them on them for it, you know, the only answer to stuff like that is just transition moves, mm-hmm. and education, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm sure if you explain to a laborer that, you know, he's screwing up the water table, potentially.
And how's he going to feed his family?
Right, exactly. So on the one hand, you know, you got survival issues. On the other hand, you got environmental issues. And that's kind of up to us as labor organizers to try to bridge that knowledge gap.
You know, there is this thing called the Blue-Green Alliance.
Yes.
It's been around for at least 15 years.
I would say.
And that is a collaboration between the environmental people and unions. I think that's steel workers.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess the big crux of the topic of this roundtable discussion is, you know, why do workers who are part of specifically trade unions have also a tendency or a current within them that also like to push for regressive forms of politics, or who might be exclusionary of certain groups within their membership? Fellow Worker Gordon?
Well, I can tell you from personal direct experience that when I was a teenager, I was naturally protesting U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. And this was when I was growing up in New York. And I would go on marches and demonstrations, you know, to bring the troops home, stop the war in Vietnam. And only partially because, you know, because I wasn't thinking about it at the time, but I was going to be draft eligible in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And so that was a self-interest thing. But our most virulent and our most implacable enemies were what we called the hard hats. And back in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of the construction trades workers, and it was only later that I get cleared up about why, but they hated us dirty hippie peacenik demonstrators, and they would throw stuff at us, they would bully us, and they would just generally be jerks. And some physical violence would erupt from time to time. And only later did I realize that a lot of these guys, blue-collar workers, maybe not even high school graduates, right, earning a good living by being union men, but it was their sons who were getting drafted and sent to the war in Vietnam. And the white middle-class kids, they had student deferments, and they had other ways. You know, they had bone spurs. They had other ways of getting out of military service. So to me, this is one of the origins of sort of the death of the progressive working class in America, and the birth of this political split caused by the Vietnam War, which still affects people today.
Well, you would think if a working-class family had a son that was drafted and had to go over and fight and maybe die, that they would be against the war too.
Well, a lot of this is cultural. You know, these were largely Italian-American families. Mm-hmm. They were heavily represented in the construction trades. They were immigrant workers. They were black and Hispanic workers. You know, and so that whole mystique about serving in the military, serving your country, becoming a real American.
Yeah.
You know, that's a heavy cultural burden to carry. And so, you know, we have to kind of look back in retrospect. And this is what we're discussing right now, is why do people think like this? And how can we get them to change their mood?
Well, the first thing I think about is this image is still in my mind from back in the 60s. There were the peace demonstrators on a series of steps. And there's a guy, a hard hat, as you say, with an American flag on a pole with a sharp pointy thing on the end, jabbing the protester.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, it was it's pretty common. Yeah. And it was, and that developed this hatred, this class hatred, that still falls out today because white college-educated people have very little regard for blue-collar workers or people who work with their hands. They still get slighted. They're still thought of as sort of less than educated if they only have a high school, you know, diploma. And so this class hatred was generated by what group? Capitalism. And it still has effect today.
Well, in a job that's unionized, doesn't matter what your politics are, you join that union.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you don't work there. So
close shop.
They'll take anyone.
That's a good point.
Qualifies as long as they pay their dues.
Sure.
Right.
And that reflects perhaps the leadership of the union as well. Another point, in terms of workers and the environment, Alabama, United Mine Workers, ooh, big deal. They were on strike. And I read that average wage for United Mine Workers in Alabama is upwards of $90,000 a year. Mm. So let's assume that you're married, you've got kids.
And that's good money.
You got a nice house. You probably got two cars if both of you work, plus a boat for the weekend, and maybe you're going to save some money so your kids can go to college so they don't have to be miners. So when they're on strike, there's strike pay, which is not enough to live on. And I think of it as starving. The unions starve their workers back to work. Mm-hmm. And the fellow workers in the United Mine Workers in Alabama realized this, but they took their complaints to the United Mine Workers office, the bosses of the union in New York City. And it was then discovered, where did the pension and where did the funds go? They were invested in BlackRock.
Oh.
No, one of the top three global capitalist
hedge funds. Is that? Is that
that's one of the things.
Or venture capital or something
all
like
that stuff. I mean, they make money. They make a lot of money using our funds that we deposit with them. And it turns out that BlackRock owns stock in the corporation that owns the mines.
What do you know?
That are on strike. Yeah. They're good choices if you want to make a lot of money. They're not good choices if you're a worker.
Call on yourself, and then I've got something to say.
Yeah, I think to kind of balance both, to kind of add something to this conversation, I think that the mainstream conservative counter element that exists in a lot of the major trade unions, like you said, A, they're willing to take whatever workers want to join a union shop so that the union can collect dues and so that that worker can get the benefits of the union without understanding exactly why they have the union in the first place. I think when it comes specifically to the context around the time of the Vietnam War and how there were a lot of blue collar union workers who were, you know, harassing people who were protesting against the war, just openly defiant of them, It touches on two things, which is the kind of patriotism that existed at that time. It still exists. This overwhelming loyalty to your country, no matter what.
Jingoism.
And it's defined as being a man.
Yes.
That was another
predominantly,
element.
Yeah. But I think the other element specifically of it, and this kind of goes towards the fact that pretty much since 1945 onwards, there's been, arguably even further back than that, I think that the streak of anti-communism specifically that runs in this country, of anything that's left of center-left, is a far-gone conclusion that any kind of collective action, any kind of transformation of society, even if it was through reform and not outright revolution, is kind of impossible or unthinkable or anti-American, so on and so forth, I think really seeped its way into the labor movement. And that comes predominantly from just a lack of education. When was the last time a local labor union put on, like, here's a history of our union, here's the people that actually started it? You know, why does unionism exist in the first place? What were the working conditions when the labor movement started in this country? I mean, the kids in high school and even in college don't really get that kind of education.
No, they never do. I was a member of the Machinists for 30 years. And maybe attended 4 or 5 meetings in that whole time because they didn't encourage people to attend meetings, and they were kind of like going to a kangaroo court It was, you know, old business, new business, you know, motion carried, blah, blah, blah. It was highly undemocratic. You couldn't elect for your own stewards. They appointed the stewards. And so, you know, that's the whole point. Our union runs things differently. We're very open and democratic in the IWW. Mm-hmm. Some people say a little too much. Yeah. But no, it's better to have more democracy than no democracy. So
even if our business meetings keep dragging on as long as they do, at least it's a democratic process.
I'm willing to suffer the will of the masses, fellow worker.
You'd be there till midnight. Marilyn, you had something to say?
Well, I did, but I don't know if it's really relevant now. I was just going to bring up that in the late 60s, early 70s, I went down and I picketed the Tacoma smelter for the first Earth Day. And the workers were very hostile toward me.
Yeah.
And I was concerned about health effects, you know, the pollution, sure, the lead, the cadmium, the arsenic. And they were real clear that they needed the paycheck. Don't take my paycheck away.
Right. Mm-hmm. You're taking food out of my kid's mouth.
Right. Never mind that this person was going to be dead in 10 years because of the poisoning.
I have a couple things to respond to. First of all, what you said about the smelter. I was in a group called Tahomans for a Healthy Environment, and the smelter was our issue. And I remember going to a meeting, community to discuss whether the smelter should stay or should it go. Mm-hmm. And there was one woman who represented the smelter, the Smelters Union, and she had claimed she had done some research and found out that people that lose their jobs commit suicide. So, oh dear, we can't leave the smelter because people will kill themselves. On the other hand, the smelter's killing the children who live in Ruston, who play outdoors. Gordon, I'm not picking on you, but yes I am. You keep making references to blue-collar workers. In my opinion, it's different. So what does the average union member look like today?
Probably a lot different from when I was an industrial worker.
She's in her 30s, and she's working on her master's degree.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
She's a teacher. She's a nurse. She wants to go to law school. Those are your union members today. Mm-hmm. Majority of, or I mean, and look who's the leadership of the AFL. She's a woman. Women are taking over. Like, they should. Mm-hmm.
My grandpa Harry, he was my step-grandpa. He was the first longshoreman in our family. Never worked. He was a timber guy, but he never worked at the smelter. But everyone he knew, he lived down on 35th and Cheyenne, you know, kind of old town area. And I was really against the, you know, the smelter. And he says, but those men need jobs. And I said, but I said, also this war is so terrible, it should stop. And he says, that's got to go on. And so anyway, from that point on, my grandpa and I didn't deal with each other. And I have mixed feelings about it because then he died and I felt bad, but it was like a bridge we couldn't meet.
Yeah.
Well, I think the capitalists use that to drive wedges too.
Mm-hmm. The political wedge that keeps working people from actually recognizing that a lot of their struggles are the same in reality.
Yeah.
In terms of working conditions and workers' safety. And again, this conversation that keeps happening of, well, workers need jobs. And then the question gets raised of, well, what kind of job should that look like?
Yeah.
What should the conditions of that work and the payment for that work look like? I mean, kind of bringing it back to the topic of how there's reactionary elements within unions themselves. You know, I think it's a lack of education. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the unions do bear that responsibility. Because as I said, there's no place in public education for a working class perspective on the history of this country. Mm-hmm. Maybe in some of the blue states or blue cities, there might be a trickle of that in the public education system. But most of the labor history I learned, I had to take that on as a personal project, essentially. And I think that something else that kind of I keep noticing again and again and again, it's this mindset of hyper-individualism that's unique to this country. Yes, I'm represented by a union. Yes, I'm in a union workplace, but this is for my personal individual benefit for me and my family and my ability to afford nice things. And it's like, you're completely missing out on the fact that you are part of a collective group of working people who have banded together in order to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. And the collectivist aspect of that gets completely lost, even within the trade unions. I know there's been a lot more progressive elements beginning to show up in the trade unions movement specifically again. But that hyper-individualist mindset and that lack of education seems to be sticking around. And I think that if there was to be any significant reform in those institutions, those would be the two places I would target. Is a labor history of the United States of America should be provided in some form from unions, even if that doesn't make the trade unions look
And why would the bosses be happy with that?
Well, maybe not your boss, but...
The people who control the school board.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, yeah.
See how far that would go.
I mean, within the unions, within the unionized workers, there should be a program of education of this is how the union works. Why does the union exist? What is the history of the labor movement in this country? Who are the key figures and events? Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
I have a couple of books at home that actually were products of a, I'm going to say political education. They probably had a different term for it. But I've got one by the Machinists and one by UE, the United Radio Electric Workers. And they describe sort of inter-union struggle. The book I have was written by a machinist and was called Blood in the Water. And what they were doing was talking about a jurisdictional dispute between Teamsters and machinists. Hmm. And it got bloody, and it was at Boeing. It got, you know, there was street violence about this. And it was basically the Teamsters were trying to raid the machinists' members and bring them into their union. So these kind of discontents have been published in the past. And the UE book was similar. They were discussing a strike, a particular strike that happened, and how they, you know, how they organized it, how they won. And so they used to come out with books like this.
Is that book Labor's Untold Story?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Good
Labor's,
book.
Labor's Untold Story, exactly
like,
right.
Yeah, I'll add one more to that. Joyce Corr Blue's Rebel Voices.
Oh, I got that.
It's the best, I believe, except for our own tradition. We've got
Fred Thompson's.
The first 50 years of the history of the IWW from, 1905 to 1955? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then John Beckin, who was General Secretary Treasurer, added some additional chapters, so it was the first 100 years.
Yeah, I got that.
So that's a good source of information about the history of the IWW.
Right.
But I think Joyce Corr Blue's Rebel Voices is even better. It's detailed. And then the current edition has a new section on cartoons.
Oh, good.
By Franklin Rosemont, how the IWW used the popular media as a way to spread information and ideas. Mm-hmm. And cartoons.
Yeah, they
were good. Whether you were literate or not, you got the point if you looked at the picture.
I think another great book for all of our fellow listeners out there as well, specifically about the history of the IWW that just came out, I believe, within the last year, is called Under the Iron Heel. I've been meaning to read this book for a while because it talks about specifically how there was a very progressive and radical element to the labor movement, the IWW, that gained a huge momentum and had a massive organizing capacity within this country from 1905 to 1925, and how the government, in collusion with big business interests, worked together to try and break up that union as hard as possible, including with outright violence. Of course, a lot of the fellow workers in our union have heard the stories of Frank Little and Wesley Everest and plenty of others who have been literally murdered for trying to
organize.
And Joe Hill for trying to organize and agitate workers. But yeah, I mean, I think something else that I notice a lot in the labor movement as well, kind of touching on the election, which we are now staring down the barrel of, is I think a lot of the major trade unions focus on electoralism, both internally and externally, mm-hmm. for how the labor movement is going to progress, whether that's waiting to vote on the next contract, waiting to vote on the next union president, waiting to vote on the next, you know, local representative or president of the country. And I think the context gets lost that the labor struggle continues regardless of who's in office. Yes, I do believe personally that you should vote for people who set the conditions for which you organize. And I'm sure that there's a whole conversation that we can have about that for another time. But at the end of the day, the labor movement has to keep going regardless of what's happening on a political level.
Because one of the things that certainly happens at our Pierce County Labor Council is that candidates for office come and put a pitch in, and then a lot of the energy from those union members goes into knocking on doors for candidates instead of dealing with their real labor issues. Mm-hmm.
I actually have a great anecdote about this from the time that I used to sit in on those Central Labor Council meetings. And I do want to go to Central Labor Council meetings again, especially now that I'm a dual carder with a trade union from a local near in Tacoma. I remember, I think it was a year or two back, there was somebody who was running for, it was one of the county council positions, and they had come in to do their pitch to all the representatives of the unions that were gathered that evening. And, you know, she seemed like a wonderful woman. I genuinely believe that she was a, you know, progressive candidate. She talked a lot about, if I'm remembering this correctly, how her family members were union members, and she recognized the importance of how that impacted her life. And I'm like, that's great. That's cool. I'm sure you're a great person, and I'm sure you'd be great for this position. But the one question that I really wanted to ask the whole time that was sitting in the back of my head was, what are you actually going to do for organized labor once you get into office? And if your office can even contribute to the betterment of organized labor? And that question never got asked. And
it was assumed.
Right. It was assumed that because the person is on paper pro-labor, they come from a, you know, union family, yada, 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 that therefore they are going to do something for organized labor once they get into office. But nobody asked that question. And that just ate at me for weeks of like, this person really came in and gave a whole campaign pitch. And the biggest and most important question that could have been asked was never vocalized.
Right.
And then they voted and endorsed the candidate.
And then you also get the candidates that say they're going to do X, Y, and Z. They're going to be such good elected officials. And then once they get the vote, they betray the unions.
Yeah, now, we're going to codify Roe again. Don't worry. Yeah.
I actually doorbelled for Marilyn Strickland before she got her position. And then she had the nerve to stand in front of a grocery store downtown, a little one, that was on strike, and actually walked in and said, Tacoma is open for business. So, and now she wants to run for higher office? I don't think she's got my vote.
Well, isn't she a representative?
She is, in Congress, and she was on the one of the talk shows on MSNBC last night, and I was shocked to see her on there like a reasonable person. Well, tell the other examples that horrified me about the Native American
movement. Yeah, so back when we were fighting the LNG plant going in, there was a huge gathering of indigenous people here in the Tacoma area. They were doing a lot of work down in Olympia and all over the place. And the indigenous women decided to meet at Wright Park and walk down to city council and go to city council meeting and testify at the meeting. And I was walking with them. Marilyn Strickland heard that they were coming and had the security lock the door so they couldn't get in.
A lockout.
Yeah.
that just can't be legal.
She did it.
But I mean, why didn't she get recalled or something?
Why'd you call a cop? That would do you. Yeah. That's illegal.
The other thing she did is she completely eliminated citizens' comment at city council. She
can't
took
have that.
Major funding from the oil and gas industry and from Puget Sound Energy when she was running for office. She welcomed Puget Sound Energy to come in and do the tank before they got the approvals. And then she fought the whole structure by which they decide whether or not it's appropriate to have down here. So she fast-tracked it as much as she could.
Well, what do you expect they paid her?
Yeah, but anyhow, we're completely off topic then.
No. I think that this is relevant because, again, it drives home the point that you were making, Marilyn, that
I doorbelled for that woman. Oh, my God.
Right. And again, I think that there's a conversation that could be had in the future about, you know, whether or not these candidates are actually willing to follow through on these so-called progressive policies. What kind of conditions do you want to organize in, I think, is a question that comes up to me, because I know that in the last episode I was kind of hyping up the Democratic Party. I just want to make it very clear to the listener, I have plenty of overwhelming grievances with them as well. I don't like feeling like
corruption can happen on either side.
Right. And also the logic of voting for a lesser evil when the lesser evil isn't even that less of an evil, I think, is another conversation that can be had. I feel almost guilted or goaded into voting for them because they are at least the most progressive choice that's on the ballot. But when your options are 1,000 bombs getting dropped on Gaza, or only 900 bombs getting dropped on Gaza, it still doesn't change the fact that we're still supporting a state that is actively engaging in a genocide. Or even if the Democrats come off as more pro-labor, it doesn't exactly mean they're going to stock the National Labor Relations Board with the best possible people. Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of, and I see this in politics again and again and again, it's all about being vocally pro-labor, walking a picket line like Biden did.
Words are cheap.
Or, you know, saying you're going to reform the Supreme Court or pass better labor laws or whatever. And again, it brings me back to this point of, I want to organize under conditions that are beneficial for organization. I don't want someone to pull the trigger at me figuratively or literally anytime soon. But on the other hand, the labor organizing struggle continues regardless. It's the labor movement amongst many others that have been the forefront of progressive policies and changes in this country. And I think that that point gets missed by both the trade unions and by the political sphere. So regardless of who you vote for, what are you doing for your local, essentially? And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM, KTAH. Fellow worker important.
Yeah, so this brings us back to possible solutions or possible ways to address what we see as a recalcitrance on some part of the labor movement to vote for conservative causes for whatever reasons. And, okay, maybe not conservative, reactionary causes for whatever reason they think they should. And we touched on a couple of things that could be done. And part of it is, well, the way the IWW works is usually one-on-one at first. You know, we talk to workers face-to-face and get a feel for what they're thinking and what their grievances are. But then again, when we get in a larger affinity group, then it could be time for some more direct education, either about labor history or our methods.
For the last time that I will ever mention it.
I bet it's not.
And Andreas Malm's How to Blow Up a Pipeline. He specifically wrote the book for an environmentalist perspective. But again, I'm going to bring up the point that there needs to be an escalation of tactics at some point. I think a lot of the things that have been happening, even in the major trade unions, have been some pretty cool developments. Thinking about organizing industrially, trying to form a more progressive space for all workers so that they feel safe and protected, really driving those organization campaigns as hard as possible, and actually being upfront about who you're struggling against. I think those are really cool developments. But again, what's the next escalation of tactics going to be? Because even if all the Starbucks workers finally get a contract, even if all of the automakers in the South finally get a contract, what's going to happen next? And I see the IWW as being the only union in this country seriously asking that question of, what is the future of labor going to look like in the next 50 to 100 years? Because if it's just the next contract negotiation, what's the point? If those contract negotiations can't even beat inflation or just barely beat them in some cases, what's the next step that has to be asked on a national level?
And we have to add also, if we're just bargaining for the next contract and we're in an industry that is contributing to climate catastrophe, what are you looking at 5 years down the road?
Right.
Not because, 50, not 100.
Yeah.
You think we'll be around? People will be around in 100 years?
I'm going to have to stick around.
Probably not.
Because if we don't, even birds teach their young ones not to foul their nest. And if we are fouling our nest, there won't be any jobs on a dead planet, as Alan likes to say.
Fellow worker Gordon, I know that we've been talking a lot about books in our roundtable discussion. I see that you have a book for book review.
Yeah, and strangely enough, it relates to all the previous discussion we've had on this episode. Literally, the title of the book is Remaking Society. And it's by a kind of controversial left figure. He's been writing and publishing, or he had been writing and publishing for years. His name is Murray Bookchin. So the book is Remaking Society by Murray Bookchin. And it was originally published in 1989 by Black Rose Books. I think that label is still in existence. So you can look them up, Black Rose Books. And Murray Bookchin is an interesting, or was an interesting guy, lifelong identified as a libertarian socialist. Okay, so that word I know has fraught these days in the United States because libertarian has been hijacked by certain ANCAP type people who just, they don't like government because they can't have chattel slaves and they can't,
What's ANCAP?
ANCAP is anarcho-capitalists, so people who believe that there can be a pro-capitalist interpretation of anarchist philosophy.
Right.
Yeah.
The first couple of chapters of this book are the ones I least highlighted or underlined because it was kind of background information for me. He takes us through, civilizations, really, and especially his model of the Greek idea of the polis, which is a fundamental political unit, sort of like meaning the township and all the people in it. And the Greeks' efforts, not always successful, after all they had slaves in their society, but there were efforts to try to make government more egalitarian and not a representative type government, but the people are the government. So this is a very anarchic idea. Murray Bookchin was attracted to that. But the first pamphlet that he wrote, I looked them up online, was something to do about the poisons in our food. So he, early on, you could argue that he was an ecologist before he became, noted as an anarchist thinker. But he coined the phrase eco-socialism. Interesting phrase, because he was, I think, one of the first guys in the modern era to tie ecology and the health of the planet to political change in our society. And he did it. He did it very convincingly. He has some ideas that are kind of out there, like what did he call that? Municipalism, mm-hmm. something like that. And it's sort of just kind of a radical Paris Commune type of idea. I don't know how practical a lot of the stuff is as far as solutions, but he is definitely a person who gives you food for thought. When he gets out of the history of hierarchies and how the nation state developed and patriarchal relations and some of the myths of patriarchy, you know, like original societies were not patriarchal in many cases. Native American culture were not patriarchal. So it's very interesting that he ties that in to his critique of the current day ecology movement. He was really critical because what he was noticing is that what we were talking about earlier when we talked about shutting jobs down without just compensation was that the ecologists, and he put that in quotes, didn't care. They didn't care about the people or the fate of the people, and even developed trends within the movement, within the green movement even, of anti-humanism. Humans are the curse of the planet, and we're an aberration evolutionarily. Is that a word?
There's a new phrase for it now, which is ecofascism.
Probably pretty apt.
Right, and ecofascism is a term meant to kind of describe that thinking of, you know, we heard from some stupid people on the internet during COVID, you know, oh, humans were the virus all along.
Right.
Oh, you know, we need to focus on overpopulation in the global south so that we can balance out our ecology better. Yeah. And it's like, that's basically just saying certain people need to die so we can save the earth.
It's an extension, a modern day extension of eugenics.
Yes. It's arrogant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, and it's very classist.
And I'm going to say this over the air. There are some people that are so arrogant that they think that their poop doesn't stink.
That's right.
You know, and they drive me nuts.
Yeah.
Well, it's a holier-than-thou type of situation where you're not pure, you know, you're not ideologically pure. And so he really cuts that kind of philosophy to pieces. And you might think he goes on a little too much, but remember, he wrote this at the dawn of the 1990s, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. So that's well over 35 years ago.
I do see movements starting to soften a little bit in their attitudes generally.
Well, because they have children, and they have their children's friends and relatives, and you know, you have to be human.
Yeah.
You can't be an ascetic and demand that everybody else be pure.
Robots are not going to save the world.
That's right. Neither is technology. However, Murray Bookchin gets into technology a lot in the latter chapters of this book, which I found I had highlighted the hell out of, because there's literally too many things here to give you thought about what a new economy would look like. But essentially, he was saying what we're saying. It's a question of education. It's a question of getting people to see. Well, the way he put it is that human beings are a part of evolution. We are evolving along with all the other creatures and life forms on the planet.
We are animals. We are part of Earth.
So he sort of dispensed with that notion that we were the virus all along. He gets into some possible solutions, but basically it's education. And having people, it's sort of really, really deep, to be able to fundamentally change their point of view to see the world and, of course, the greater cosmos, which we're finding more planets than we found stars, you know, with the new telescopes and everything.
But you know what we can add to that?
Sure.
Human beings almost universally want a sense of belonging and usefulness.
Exactly.
And so, in addition to education, if you can offer them that sense of belonging in a positive way,
mm-hmm.
those two together can promote action.
Well, he emphasizes just those points.
Mm-hmm.
He emphasizes what meaningful work means. He emphasizes what, you know, how we can, they're now calling it just transition, which basically means a plan to get people, you know, decent jobs, technical jobs, jobs that they can work, that don't pollute, that don't contribute to the death of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Ali, you had a thought?
In terms of the ecology, I think that he and we have the opportunity, the potential to learn, to grow, and to change. And Murray has done that in his career.
Yeah, yeah.
Early on, when I was reading his stuff, he had a technological solution to pollution,
right,
which is get air-conditioned machines that could mine coal. Mm-hmm. Well, hooray for the worker who gets to get an air conditioning machine.
Right.
The haul of the coal that's burned up already and is making my great-grandkids crispy critters in the future.
But you do bring up a good point, Alan, which is that people can evolve, can change. Right, he gives evidence of that you could admit to your own error.
So in terms of technology, I'm reminded of John Trudell,
poet. Yeah.
Native American poet. He was leader of the American Indian movement for a while.
Yes, he was.
And in some of his poems and speeches, he refers to technology as technologic. Mm-hmm. There is no logic to it.
It's just
making things worse.
Mm-hmm.
And there are less harmful ways or non-harmful ways to change the things that need to be changed to make this place a better place for all of us to live, including the grandmas and the great-grandkids. And feathered things and the things that float and swim.
Yeah, they're all our relatives.
Mm-hmm. All our relations.
I mean, there is definitely discussion to be had about what the technological future of society is going to look like if we are aiming for the kind of society that is run by the working class or is more equitable or is more ecologically friendly or balanced with the rest of the ecosystem. Personally, from my perspective, it's not the fact that technology in and of itself is bad. It just depends on how that technology is going to be used and what kind of methods of production are needed to produce it. You know,
who writes the code and who pushes the buttons?
Exactly. And how is the working class going to benefit from the existence of that technology should be another question, at least from the perspective of the technological aspect of ecology. Fellow worker Gordon, did you have any other notes on that book?
Just that he talks about... I'm plugging the book because Murray Bookchin is a fraught character, not just in left politics or left points of view. Even amongst people who think like he did, had arguments with him. I've heard that he was kind of a cranky old guy who could be a real pain in the neck. I heard our own Arthur J. Miller, the late Arthur Miller, had arguments with Murray about well, Arthur would argue with you about...
Yeah,
you know,
they were both too cranky old men.
Maybe. But what I'm getting at is that I'm not recommending this book to embrace the author's philosophy in toto. What I'm saying is that this will open up a lot of different perspectives, and it gives you an anarchist point of view and a utopian socialist point of view, and kind of puts the dish on Marxism as being what it is, which is authoritarian and pseudoscientific. But he also had a couple of criticisms of syndicalists, which I consider myself being an IWW. But
excuse me, Gordon.
Yeah.
Why don't you share for us your interpretation of the meaning of the word syndicalist?
Okay.
Or Marxist, for that matter.
Okay.
All right.
You want to get into that?
I am a little bit of a Marxy fanboy over here. So.
Well, I was a Marxist for years and years and changed. I hadn't even heard of anarchism because they drilled it out of our heads, essentially.
Right, but I think you're speaking specifically to the Leninist and also Maoist interpretations of Marx.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, ML.
Well, let's pick on Karl and his buddy Engels. Come on.
But Karl, okay, was a product of his century, which is the 19th century, and which considered itself the century of science, and science with a capital S. And so to gain credibility for his actual economic interpretation of the world, he had to make it into a science, because that was what had, you know, a staying power with the intellectual elites of the day. So he was basically selling a doctrine through using a coding of science and the inevitability of certain forces of history and how things develop from point to point. Now, what was the other term?
So he manipulated.
Well, yes, he was also a brilliant scholar, and he also came up with a lot of very good ways to analyze capitalism and how it worked. However, his solutions ended up, not Marx and Engels, but his immediate successors, ended up being very doctrinaire and ended up being very authoritarian, and then you end up with a guy like Joseph Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was the other thing you wanted?
Syndicalist is what I asked, but that's good enough.
Okay, syndicalist. Yeah. Syndicalist is a person on the left, meaning that they believe in some kind of socialist economic organization, but they also believe that unions are the pattern or the blueprint for how society can be run.
Mm-hmm.
So syndicalists, and they confederate. So in other words, you have all these different crafts and trades that do their own things, like leather work or even things like teaching or whatever, or manufacturing objects. but they can work together through their unions to actually govern
society.
Society, but on a very localized level is what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. The confederation model, don't misunderstand me, is just these different unions who are agreeing to work together for the protection and the betterment of the whole community.
Bookchin, later in his life, was also critical of certain elements within, like you said, syndicalists and also anarchist movements as well. He was especially critical of lifestyleism, which was becoming prominent in a lot of...
What is that?
Lifestyleism was his criticism that a lot of specifically anarchist movements tend to focus on anarchism as a way of living your life, as a lifestyle, rather than actually as a broader social economic movement in order to liberate us from capitalism or certain forms or all forms of hierarchy, things like that.
He was also highly critical of the movement that we all lived through, which was the sort of the counterculture. We were all part of the counterculture at one point in our more youthful days, but he was criticizing the mysticism that he was beginning to see form up in the ecology movement. Mm-hmm. You know, he was highly critical of using magical and spiritual and talismanic type methods of...
The woo-woo stuff.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, he was kind of an equal opportunity critic. If anybody who's on the left in the audience reads this book, you're going to find something to disagree with Murray about. But, you know, he wasn't...
Well, now you've gotten me really curious.
Oh, he wrote several things. His major work was... The Ecology of Freedom, which I read, and that's a good one. And then he also wrote, which I haven't read yet, The Rise of Urbanization and the Decline of Citizenship. So he's highly critical. You and I come from back east, and you know that that's pretty much one big city from Philadelphia to Boston.
Megalopolis.
Yeah, it is. And he says this does more damage to the human psyche.
Is this guy, when did he write this book?
1989.
So he's not still alive.
He died in 2006. So he was an old guy. He was born in 1921, so he's like 85 years old. And he kept writing, and he kept ticking people off. You know, he ticked off our own Arthur J. Miller. So, but anyway, what I'm getting at is that he contributed a lot of scholarship. And as fellow worker Alan has pointed out, he evolved. Mm-hmm. And he was like, it was like a public evolution.
And I think that this also kind of hits on a note that I don't think gets talked about within left-wing political or unionist movements, is that a lot of those thinkers did evolve their positions over time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes their later statements might contradict some of their earlier work. And it's good to recognize that human beings are human beings, and they change, especially when it comes to views on politics or economics or things like that.
Some of them devolved.
This is coming from a former libertarian here.
But the original meaning of the word libertarian, which I mentioned earlier, not to denigrate your former beliefs, is that libertarian used to be an individualist, and that was also synonymous in Europe for anarchist.
Right.
And so this is what upsets me when people hijack each other's symbolism or art form or slogans, like the Nazis did to the socialists.
Right.
They even had to stick socialist in their name just so that they could get votes.
For a working class.
We're all for the working man.
But thank you for that book.
I'll repeat.
Rename it one more time.
Okay, this is called Remaking Society by Murray Bookchin. I'll spell B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N, Bookchin. And it was published by Black Rose Press, 1989. And you can probably find it through your local subversive booksellers like AK or PM Press. But look it up online, Remaking Society.
Thank you. Marilyn, you had a report back on the Workers' Rights Summit.
I did. So the last 2 weeks have been a really busy time for me. It's summertime. There's been a lot of tabling and a lot of street fairs. There's one going on right now up in Proctor.
Mm-hmm.
Last weekend was something called Mosaic, otherwise known as Ethnic Fest. The reason why it's called Mosaic is it got farmed out to a private company. So they thought they would change the name. And how Mosaic is as accurate a description of that wonderful festival as Ethnic Fest, I don't know. But right in the middle, on the first day, Saturday, was the Workers' Rights Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was over at Evergreen Tacoma. So I was tabling with Veterans for Peace and Jewish Voice for Peace all weekend at Mosaic. But I dashed up to Evergreen Tacoma to make it to the Workers' Summit. So it was sponsored by the school. It was sponsored by Democratic Socialists. And it was sponsored by UFCW 367.
Mm-hmm.
and other branches. And there are four main complaints that they've had, and they're launching a campaign. So they had speakers from Kroger's workers. They had speakers from Safeway, speakers from Macy's, and speakers from, I'm trying to remember the other one. Well, anyhow, speakers from workers from different
retail outfits
in the food and commercial workers sector. And they also had the president of the local 367. Mm-hmm. The four issues they had, and these, you know, this is across the board, $20 an hour minimum wage, not just for themselves, but for workers throughout Washington. They need a living wage. The other issue that most of them have is shifting work hours. And why? When you think about it, why do they keep, like at McDonald's or at Kroger's, why are you on day shift and then suddenly you're on swing or suddenly you're on night? If you have a family and you have children, how the hell do you plan your life? And if you're given only 24 hours notice that your shift is going to change, how the hell do you plan for that? What is the function in that? And I have to say, one of the things it does is it keeps the workers off balance. And the second thing it does is it promotes high turnover.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have high turnover, it's harder to organize.
Mm-hmm. Bingo.
Yeah. So they want predictable schedules, and they want to work enough, they want opportunity to work enough hours for a livable paycheck. Don't keep them just below the 40 hours a week so you don't have to pay them the full scale or give them the full benefits. They want 40 hours a week. And all of these places have been reducing the workforce. So now it could be you're at Kroger's and you're the only person in the bakery. And if somebody comes in that's dangerous or scary, you're by yourself.
Or if you just have a high workload, you're by yourself.
Well, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So those are the four issues. And they've been trying to work with these different entities, especially Kroger's and Safeway, and not getting very far. So this is the beginning of a campaign that they're launching.
Mm-hmm.
And where it goes, we'll have to tune in and wait and see, but something may happen in spring of next year.
Yeah.
And, of course, the IWW will be in solidarity of these for these workers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I've spoken with a couple of the organizers who are part of this campaign for the Workers' Bill of Rights.
Oh, August 26th, Monday, August 26th, 7 o'clock at 621 Tacoma Avenue South, known as Common Good. It's kind of like the kitchen area for First United Methodist Church. You go around back for it.
Yeah. I've been to a couple of those meetings, and I've spoken with a couple of the organizers for the Workers' Bill of Rights. I think something interesting from a specifically pro-union perspective that I've spoken to them about is, and I think that this is also a point of consideration for a lot of unions, is that we do have the collective power to affect policy on a local level. And if we could make it easier to organize a union or protect unions at a local level, because at the federal level, who knows what it's going to be after November, then I think that that would be a really interesting step for them to take.
Well, what I wanted to caution the listener about, and what we all need to be aware of, is we saw how hard city council tried to fight back about the Tenants' Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
and how all of the real estate and developers threw money into that. What do you think is going to happen when the grocery workers are trying to gain some equality? These grocery stores, these mega food chains that are making huge profits, are going to throw money into misinformation and fighting against this. It's going to be a very tough battle.
Right.
And, you know, you may be a fellow worker who's getting off of work and you want to buy a few groceries because you got to go home and make dinner for your kids. And there may be a problem with not many people working in the stores. They may be out on strike. They may be doing a slowdown. They may be doing any one of a number of things. Please have patience, because that could be you. Mm-hmm. Have empathy.
Yeah, I mean, I remember from the Tenants' Bill of Rights that got passed by a narrow margin. I remember looking at the map that Home and Tacoma for All had after the election results were announced, was that the majority of North Tacoma along the peninsula, as well as some of the suburbs of Northeast Tacoma there, kind of over by the other side of the port, were all very much against it, whereas a lot of the more working class communities in Central and South and downtown Tacoma were very much in favor of it. So it'll be interesting to see how this campaign turns out if they want to put this towards initiative, because I believe that they do want to make this an initiative on one of the local upcoming ballots. It'll be really interesting to see how they want to address those areas as well, because those are a part of Tacoma that have a higher income bracket, probably because a lot of them do own those local businesses or
managers.
It
sounds to me like you want to go to the next meeting on Monday, August 26th at 7 o'clock at 621 Tacoma Avenue South. I will tell you, the speakers were phenomenal. I mean, I am always in awe when a working class person gets up and they are so eloquent and they're so able to articulate right off the cuff what it is that they're about and what their story is. And it just really grabbed me.
It's a perspective you don't hear that often.
Unfortunately, I had to leave a few minutes early and go back down to my table where I was working to educate people about the genocide in Gaza and the U.S.'s role in sending our tax dollars in the form of military aid to Israel. For the genocide. So that's what I was doing, and I had to run back there. But I really wanted to stay here longer and hear more because people were starting to gather and brainstorm. And I missed out on that.
Maybe the branch could keep tabs on this outfit.
I think our branch should definitely show up at that meeting on the 26th, you said?
Monday, August 26th at 7 o'clock. At 621 Tacoma Avenue South, you go around the back.
Do you mind if I do a quick Tacoma Pride report back?
No, I don't mind at all.
So I recently tabled with one of our local broadcasters who carries WOB Radio. That's 95.3 KTQA. We had a good time tabling and interacting with the public at Tacoma Pride. But I think something that was interesting in my observation was Tacoma Pride really wanted to stress some kind of interactivity with a lot of the people who were applying to be vendors and such. The Tacoma IWW had sent in an application and got denied because I imagine everybody rushed to put in an application for Tacoma Pride all at the same time. But I think it was interesting because I didn't really see a whole lot of, at least from what I saw, union presence at Tacoma Pride like there has been in previous years. Usually locals set up their own booth and try to educate people and get people interested in becoming a part of whatever union they're a part of. So that was kind of the one disappointing thing that I saw, frankly. But other than that, we had a good time. We got a bunch of new radio bumpers for the top of the hour. And potentially, for our fellow listeners out there, a couple of upcoming interviews, perchance, as soon as I hear back from those folks. So keep in touch about that. Yeah. So that's kind of my brief Tacoma Pride report.
Go ahead. I want people to keep in mind that the Golden Rule will be in Tacoma August 13th from 5 until 8 o'clock at the Peace Park on Dock Street. Thank you. So that's August 13th. The event is free. The Golden Rule is the boat that's being brought by Veterans for Peace to Tacoma and all along the West Coast to educate about the dangers of wars, the danger of nuclear weapons, and the need for working on peaceful solutions to potential conflicts. War is not the answer. The sailboat is going to be at the Peace Park. I think it's at 705 Dock Street is the address. And people will be able to get on board. We'll have speakers from kids from the Marshall Islands that were affected by nuclear testing. We'll have music. We'll have Sean Arendt will be back from Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That he gets back the day before.
Local friend from the DSA, yeah.
Yeah, and he'll be speaking about his experiences. So that is happening on August 13th. On August 31st, if you are a peaceful person and involved in the peace and justice community, we welcome you to come out to our annual peace and justice picnic put on by a lot of different people together in community. It will be at Point Defiance Park at Fort Nisqually Group Picnic Area. Sorry about the fort, but that's the group picnic area we got. It starts at 1 o'clock. There is currently a burn ban, so we cannot have charcoal grills. But if you have a camp stove, a gas camp stove, we are allowed to use those. Bring whatever games you want to. The dog park is right around the corner. Bring your kids. The purpose of this is just to enjoy each other and acknowledge the work that we've all been doing and just take a break. So
sounds
that's
like
at
fun.
1 o'clock at the Fort Nisqually group picnic area. You're invited.
Alrighty, fellow workers, that's the end of our broadcast today. Thank you so much for joining us with the Tacoma IWW. If you're interested in getting organized locally to form a union in your workplace, you can always reach out to us at the Tacoma IWW Facebook page or Instagram page. You can get in touch with a local delegate, me and Marilyn, respectively, and we can help you start that process. So I just want to give a shout out to 101.9 KTAH, 95.3 KTQA, and 94.9 KZAX, that's our broadcaster up in Bellingham, for supporting our show and having us on the air.
And if you're interested in doing radio and you're an IWW member, we need more volunteers for WOB Radio.
Absolutely. So thank you again for joining in on our broadcast, and we wish you all the solidarity.
Solidarity.
Solidarity.